Hey, beautiful soul. This is the Menopause Coach Podcast with me, your host, Adele Johnston. I'm helping you create a vibrant life of joy and happiness without your menopause stealing your personal power and sass. Together, we're making menopause mainstream.
You know what? Sit down, luxuriate in 20 minutes on the sofa, do nothing. You know, and so if we can't do that, how are we going to do that, you know, in that other part of our lives? So I think adopting a principle that pleasure is necessary and a core part of being a happy human, wherever you find that pleasure.
Welcome back to another episode of the Menopause Coach Podcast. I am your host, as always, Adele Johnston, the Menopause Coach. And today I am very blessed to be joined with a special guest, Dr. Angela Wright, who is a GP, a menopause doctor, and a clinical sexologist. I'm very excited to speak with her today. Angela, you have your own podcast as well, known as The Doctor, The Therapist, and The Coach. Is that right?
Yes, it is, yeah.
Very excited that we get to have this conversation today because you play a very active role at the moment inside women's health and sexual health. And I was very grateful to be able to listen to one of your teachings during a seminar that we were doing for menopause and women's health. And I was just really, really engrossed and taken aback by how beautifully you presented the clinical sexologist side of your role. And that's when I reached out to you and said, I would love to be able to interview and chat with you on the Menopause Coach Podcast. So welcome to the podcast today.
Thank you for having me on. It's lovely to be here.
Just for the purpose of the audience, because I fully appreciate that when I first read the words clinical sexologist, I was a bit like, wow, that sounds mega cool. But what, who are you and what do you do? Let's maybe start there.
Okay. So, I mean, I always think it sounds like a made up title. It doesn't sound like there's any kind of training or qualification behind it, but it's what we now tend to call people who are trained in psychosexual therapy or sexual medicine, but sexual medicine from the perspective of helping with sexual function rather than STIs and contraception and, you know, the kind of GYN medicine side of things. So I'm a conventionally trained GP. I'm a British Menopause Society accredited menopause specialist, but what I do that's slightly different is I work in depth with women and men actually who are struggling with libido or sexual function or sexual pain, and obviously there's quite a lot of those issues that are prevalent for people as they go through menopause.
Absolutely. Do you know, I think as well, like, and I love that you do this, I think what we find a lot of the time, especially within the sexual side of our health and well-being, is that there's still this embarrassment and almost this shame or attachment to shame that can be in that level of conversation. And
yeah.
Do you find that that comes out a lot in the work that you do?
Before I did this job, I used to work in palliative medicine, and I used to work in hospice. And I sometimes think it's a bit odd that I've trained in these two areas that involve difficult conversations. But I think that's the thing that I really like about it is most people who are struggling with that kind of existential issue about, you know, essentially, can I be in a relationship with somebody and have everything functioning and have everything as I want it to be for intimacy? It's really weighty, difficult stuff that people struggle with on their own.
Mm.
And so to be able to be in a position where you can give people space to look at this and you can actually give them practical tips and treatments and things that help to really shift how they feel about that side of their life, it is a genuinely privileged, lovely job to do. I was working a couple of days ago with somebody who'd never been invited to have a conversation in that kind of depth about this issue, and I think medicine traditionally says it's not our problem and kind of shoves it back at people, but then you're left holding something like you say, lots of people feel really deep shame about, and that's just an awful thing to leave people with on their own.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's amazing to see how we are as human beings evolving a bit more, especially as women. We're starting to really, you know, push the boundaries a little bit in the conversations that we are now having, where it's predominantly been that bit of a taboo subject, isn't it? To sit around, you know, even just in a coffee shop and talk about how we have maybe sexual dysfunction or we have dryness or itching or bleeding during sex, which isn't then fun in any way, you know, painful. And these I'm talking about me, I'm talking about the experiences that I had during the start of my own early perimenopause journey in my mid-30s. And it really came between, because you mentioned relationships, the relationship with myself, but also with my husband. Do you find that that's something that you deal a lot with?
I don't think it matters so much whether you're, you know, in a relationship with a man and a relationship with a woman, you know, what kind of sex you're having. I think it's the fact that people often feel that nobody else is going through it, or that they don't quite know what's caused it and what they might be able to do to make it better, or even if they can do anything to make it better. So I find what happens most is that there's no communication around it. So couples shrink away from intimacy, you know, that one person develops, you know, some apprehension about it, or is worried that it's not going to be pleasurable, it's going to make them feel bad, or it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
And actually, rather than feeling comfortable to have that conversation with your partner, it's loaded with meaning. And I think it's a really difficult area to talk about with somebody that you love. And so people start to take steps around it. I often find that couples, you know, everything else in their relationship is very good, but they're going to bed at a different time, they're avoiding date nights, they're avoiding anything that might give a green light. They used to communicate that sex was on the cards.
Yeah.
So a distance opens up, and so it becomes quite lonely. But I think for both parties within the relationship. So I think that the saddest part is that it's all quite predictable. You know, none of us get through our lives unscathed without some problem, whatever, whether you're female-bodied or male-bodied, you know, any medication, any health complaint, any seriously stressful period, all of it's going to impact on how you are able to sort of, you know, express yourself in terms of sexuality. But we just talk about it so little, or if we do talk about it, we talk about this really high level, spontaneous, highly passionate, brilliant sex life that you're supposed to have. And I think most people look at what's happening for them and see the gap and think something's wrong with them, rather than realising how prevalent it is.
So true. When you see it that way, you recognise that, I mean, we've probably all been through stages. I'm 40 now, and evolving through that sexual desire and part of our life. You know, I remember having the kind of rip the clothes off sex coming through the front door of the house, and then getting to the point where it's a, oh my God, ABC's anniversary, birthday, Christmases. Is it really his birthday? Do I really need to do this? And, you know, that can probably for itself bring up a lot of the psychological element of sex and intimacy. Is that something that you, as probably in a doctor's role, hear much about, or more within the clinical psychosexual side?
It's hard to remember what people spoke to me about before I did this, because of, you know, what I found when it became, when my patients understood that I could talk about this and do something about it, was that it all came out of the woodwork. It became a really big part of my role, even when I was in general practice and not doing specialist work. I think we all have this impression that sex should just happen easily, that it should be spontaneous, that it should be easy. And we're not educated about realities around sex and attraction and how bodies change and how we change in long-term relationships. We don't get that in sex ed. You know, sex ed is taught with a focus on, you know, how bodies change in puberty and consent and, you know, which is good, and STIs and contraception and things. So you need that information, but we don't teach about pleasure, consent, communication. We don't teach about how to explore safely, how to understand what you want and communicate that to a partner. So the conversation, you know, so none of us really have the skills or the language. When you go through what is a really predictable transition, you know, much of our sexual arousal is kind of weighted towards novelty. It's just the way that brains work. So most people have that kind of 18 months early in a relationship where the sexual currency is really high, you talk about it a lot, you're anticipating it a lot, you're really connected.
Yeah.
And then a lot of couples in a monogamous long-term relationship will find that that naturally kind of dissipates as time goes on. And it's quite a normal evolution of how things work in couples, but it doesn't mean you can't do something about it. But because we're not taught that that's what we can expect, and that we need to maybe think about how to approach that proactively, people slide into feeling unhappy, feeling isolated, you know, not really feeling up for it, but feeling it's expected, and having sex because you're supposed to.
Yeah.
You know, and the joy goes out of it. And who wants to do something that is joyless?
I think coming at it from a personal experience and perspective of this, my own experience of this was, I never actually spoke to my doctor about any of my sexual dysfunction. And, you know, I openly talk about it now because this is, you know, it helps. It helps in the conversation and raising awareness. And it's almost like you said, you know, the kind of loneliness part to it of, is there something broken with me? Is there something wrong with me? Becomes part of the key aspect and theme, isn't it? And you probably hear this a lot from people.
Yeah, I think a lot of women in particular think their bodies are broken because right from the outset, mm-hmm. if you think about, you know, when I did my training, they start off by making you explore your own sexual scripts. So your sexual scripts are the things that you've learnt about sex growing up that kind of forms the framework of what you think is normal. And when you go and look into that stuff, most of us will have picked up some stuff at school, but a lot of it is stuff that we probably weren't given, you know, explicitly by somebody else. You find it in magazines, you look in books, you see things on the internet and pornography and TV and everything else. And all of those images tend to suggest that female-bodied individuals should, you know, climax through vaginal penetration, that it should be easy, that it should be quick, that we should be incredibly orgasmic and responsive and, you know, up for it and have this mm-hmm. high libido. And that isn't how a lot of people experience their bodies. So I find a lot of what I do early in a conversation with somebody is to try and debunk mm-hmm. some of that stuff. Because when you do that, you take away a large amount of the shame and that kind of internalized feeling that this is just me. I'm not going to be in a situation where I'm able to get into another relationship. Who's going to want me mm-hmm. if this is what I'm like? And that's what I think is the really tender stuff. That's, people think the job is sexy. It's not sexy. It's not kind of like how to have 7 orgasms a night. You know, it's not, it isn't like that. It's much more, how do I help you to work with your body and to understand what you want and what you need?
Yeah.
And you know, optimize your physical health so that you can get that help you to kind of communicate it. And mm-hmm. it's quite tender, like emotional work to do with people, really, because people feel quite bruised and sad when I meet them.
Yeah, I can imagine. I can, you know, I'm thinking back to where I was at that height of the challenges that I was experiencing myself. Yeah. I actually lost the ability to climax. I couldn't orgasm. And this is where, you know, you hear people saying, well, you know, the whole purpose of the clitoris is there for stimulation and for joy and sexual pleasure. But actually, it was so frustrating because then emotionally you get inside your head space and you're maybe building up to it and you think, oh, I can feel it. I can feel it coming. And then it just leaves the building and you're just so frustrated. And my husband was frustrated. And for us, it came down a lot to the fact that I was experiencing really low levels of vaginal estrogen. And amazing that, and even a non-hormonal solution to that through vaginal estrogen really supported that. And I still will use it. And I will use vaginal moisturizers and lubrications. And probably one part of this as well would be my generation of women growing up. I'm a, you know, Catholic educated girl. So we were very limited to the sex education that we actually had within the Catholic upbringing and schooling system. My parents never spoke about sex openly. My mum was always very kind of embarrassed around that. My dad, you know, you just wouldn't talk to your dad about that as a girl. So you're right. I would find everything out through Cosmopolitan magazine, and there was no podcasts and Facebook back then. We couldn't share intimacy and talks with friends unless you were having a sleepover with your girlfriends. And one of them had been a little bit more what we would call third base, you know, they experienced it and you could ask them about it, but you didn't tend to really have those conversations together. So
no, and I don't think people spoke about solo sex. You know, I think that it was also, you know, I think it was kind of expected and understood that guys did that, but I don't think for people growing up in the, you know, 80s, 90s, that it was something that was really talked about. So for a lot of the people that I see, they never really, I often get people saying, I never really understood what all the fuss was about. I never really, you know, I've never really been able to climax. And and it's almost like at menopause, one of the good things that's happened with the fact that we're talking about it more, it's that it's become a legitimate point to ask for help. Mm-hmm. But often it's that things have been rubbish for years, actually. It's not been satisfying. It's not, you know, sex has not been being had because of an innate enjoyment of it. It's often been, well, it's part of what I need to do within my relationship to keep that relationship safe. And I think there's a lot of cultural and religious and kind of societal scripts that run through how much access most women tend to feel they have to really having free choice, you know, of what happens, what touch they want, who with, what kind.
Yeah.
Most people don't, I don't think, really have been invited to really explore that from their position, rather than what would I be like as a partner? What would my partner like? You know, that focus has often been in the wrong place from my point of view.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And that even just thinking about it now, you know, very privileged and blessed that actually I live in a country where I do have the choice, that I'm with a partner, my husband, who I've been with for a very long time, that, you know, he understands that there's going to be times where it's like, wow, where's all of this friskiness and libido coming from, versus actually, you know, I am just really tired and I just want to go to sleep. I don't want you touching me tonight. So would it be right in thinking this as two forms then? We've got the kind of the physiological side of the body, so in the physical form. And of course, if we're experiencing things like perimenopause or menopausal changes, that can have us go a bit more insular in ourselves and not want to explore.
I think it's really complicated. So I often end up using the term biopsychosocial. So I use that because I think it's a really complicated jigsaw puzzle for most of us. So there's the physical stuff that happens at menopause, of which there's loads, isn't there? There's for those people that have gone through surgical menopause, obviously you're recovering from surgery, there's anatomical changes, blood supply changes. I've had women who've had their uterus and cervix removed who feel real grief for the quality of orgasm and the change in how it feels, because nobody's explained that to them beforehand. And the hormone changes obviously make a big difference, like you said, the loss of vaginal estrogen, and actually androgens are quite important as well for how the clitoris works and so on. And again, I don't think we're informed. In an ideal world, from my perspective, women would have this information as they go into this transition so that they can then choose how proactive to be about this. Because it's not as important to everybody, and we shouldn't be foisting it on them either. So you've got all of that sort of stuff, and that's in the background of whatever else is happening with your health. So, you know, lots of people who are on antidepressants will struggle to climax. It makes it almost impossible for some people. So lots of commonly prescribed stuff is a problem. Then you've got your psychology, your sort of your identity and your sexual identity, which are obviously quite intertwined. And menopause has, you know, aging connotations. We don't get lots of images it's getting better, but we don't get loads of images of really hot, sexually confident women in their 50s, 60s and 70s. So that's reflects on us. We don't have those expectations for ourselves because we're not seeing women seen in that way. And our role changes. You know, your kids grow up, you might be changing what you're doing at work, you might be feeling less confident in your own skin. So all of that feeds into how sexy you feel, how desirable you feel, which is part of things. And relationships and roles and social stuff is important too. So, you know, is it okay to be a new grandma and to feel really frisky and still want to have the sex that you had in your 20s? Is it, you know, is it okay in a new relationship to not have good libido, or to suddenly, you know, be really interested in new things in a long-term relationship where sex gets a bit typecast? All of those things put boundaries and barriers around us, and our partners might have problems too. You know, we're not, I say a lot to the people that I see, this is not just menopause. This is not just something that we have as a burden and an unsexy part of us as women. Men have loads of problems with low T and testosterone. They have erectile dysfunction. They have climax changes. Their bodies come under just as much hammer as ours do as we go through the years. So a lot of what I do is looking at all of that and just doing a little bit here and a little bit there and a little bit there, and the overall thing is it shifts.
Yeah. So do you think we're meant to continue having sex all the way through?
It's a good question. I think if you watch human behaviour, then we do tend to find that lots of people still want to, you know, and I think part of our access to our sexuality depends on our access to understanding how to optimise it as time goes on. But loads of people are still having sex in their 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s. You know, there's studies that I've got. There's a great sexologist that taught me who looked into how sex changes as you age, including limitations of being in a nursing home and what happens when you, you know, develop these increasing problems. So I don't think that's a should or a we're designed to. It's a form of expression. And I think we should feel able to be informed enough to make choices so that we can use our bodies in ways that we want to for as long as we want to. And at the moment, that isn't an option that's open to a lot of people.
Which is sad, but exactly why you do what you do, right?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, I do it because I was really inspired by the people that, when I was starting to sort of learn about this, I just thought, God, I haven't learned about any of this as a doctor. And we're sort of alongside people through normal life events, through illness, through all these situations where stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And I'd never been taught about anything other than, you know, Viagra, mm-hmm. And a bit of vaginal estrogen for people that were getting pain and dryness after menopause, but nothing about whether their pleasure had changed. Like you say, you couldn't climax. That's, mm-hmm. We don't ask women these questions. So we only ask if it hurts, mm-hmm. or if it's dry. We don't ask about the quality of sex and how their bodies feel, and can we do something to make that feel better?
Because I think when we look at the release of chemicals and, you know, neurotransmitters and connections that we have, synapse connections in the brain from when we climax, and even when we are just intimate, we don't even have to come to the point of climax for these chemical releases in the body. It could almost be kind of, you know, in a black and white, very simplistic form, argued that it's a natural antidepressant, that it's a natural mood lifter.
Yeah, there was a great slide. The sexologist I was just referring to did a great slide around how orgasm compares to painkillers, antidepressants, you know, and it scores really well because you get a release of dopamine and oxytocin and vasopressin, and, you know, then we get sort of these feelings of well-being within our bodies and natural endorphins and painkillers. Mm-hmm. If you look at the evidence, there was a study called the Cofilli study, maybe 15 or could be even 20 years old, that looked at what happens if you continue to be sexually active as you get older, and it's correlated with better life expectancy and better quality of life.
Yeah.
They even said that 100 orgasms a year was correlated with 7 more years of life.
Amazing.
So whether that's the sex or whether that's just having the body that's healthy enough to allow you to have it, or the mindset, you know, we don't know. But it's clear that if you can access that sort of pleasure, you know, if you can use your body in the way that you want to use it, then it's really good for us.
Yeah. And brings that probably when we think about, you know, we touched on this at the start, you've got that meaning assigned within life. We know that within positive psychology, and this is bringing us inside kind of Professor Martin Seligman's work within the PERMA model of positive psychology, one of the aspects of that relationships as a pillar. So in order for us to fully achieve that self-actualization and thrive within life, we do have to have strong purpose, meaning, emotional connection, relationships.
Yeah.
And I'm a massive big advocator of we need to have strong relationships with ourselves. Mm-hmm. And actually, the amount of women that I speak with that don't know what feels or looks normal for their own vulva or internally feeling into the vagina, again, it's probably not something that's ever been just openly discussed, as when you're checking yourself, for example, your breasts in the shower or bath, well, let's just make sure that we're checking our vulvas and vaginas for any changes. We don't openly have those conversations.
I mean, there's a whole history behind female pleasure. There's this whole idea of pleasure as being a form of activism, because when you look back at, you know, when we discovered the clitoris, when it turned up in medical manuals, how much it was hidden away in terms of, you know, we had the knowledge, but we weren't sharing it with people. And that was a form of control, really. And much of, I think, present day women's understandings of their own anatomy still has its roots in time periods where we were trying to kind of control these things. Mm-hmm. So there are studies that say that, you know, the ability of women to accurately name their body parts, and men actually, is shockingly poor for female anatomy. And we don't have the right language. We only have access to seeing certain types of bodies, you know, in cultures where people change in changing rooms much more often naked, and you see the sort of, you know, different ages and stages of bodies. I think there is something in that, because in our society, we tend to only see our own vulvas, and then we see those that are available to see in like pornography. We don't really get to sort of understand what our anatomy is like. And so a lot of people hold a lot of shame about all sorts of aspects of their appearance, but also about what they might like or how their bodies might work. Mm-hmm. And we can't bust that stuff. I was taught when I was training that shame generally needs light and air in order to get better. But if you grow up thinking that something is wrong with you because of how your body appears, or if you grow up thinking that it's not normal that you want to touch yourself, or maybe that you should have more libido than you do, and that something is not right about you because you don't, because we just don't educate people properly about the massive breadth of you know, diversity in how we look, and also diversity in how much and what kind of sex we might want to have, if any, and all of that's okay. I think it's just that we're ripe to internalize that stuff and think it's just us and kind of, you know, feel really bad about ourselves.
Yeah. Oh, it's just, it brings up so much, doesn't it? That the hope for me, I'm a mum of twin daughters, they're 13, two girls. Okay. And the hope for me is that actually I openly talk about and, you know, bought them multiple different books that they can read around the anatomy, the outlay of it. In fact, Dr. Nagat's book, The Knowledge. I've shared that with them recently. And, you know, my girls have been in their menstrual bleed for the last 10 months now. So we openly talk about, you know, tracking their symptoms and their periods and their bleeds and how they feel, but also checking themselves and making sure that they understand their body, because I greatly believe that if I can be that generation of mum who helps this just to be very normal, normalising the conversation of sexual pleasure, and actually, you know, it's meant to be enjoyable, but we aren't going to climax every time and we need to be able to self-explore. And you're so right. I always remember being in high school, and as girls, we would grow our nails long. And if one of them would break, that's when the boys would tease you about, oh, is that your finger that you use? And you would be so embarrassed because you would think, I don't want to admit that that's what I do. Like, I don't want to tell anybody. Is there something wrong with me because I do that? But actually looking at that now and seeing where my shift has changed with debunking that feeling of this is shameful, and actually, no, why is it any different to feeling the inside of my mouth if I have a sore part, or checking for any changes? Because actually, it's a beautiful part of my body that deserves that love and respect.
I've got three kids, and the youngest one has just done his sex education, and he's 10. Mm-hmm. So it's primary school, and they let you see the videos and things. And you know, when I was younger, there was nothing about pleasure, there was nothing about the clitoris, there was it just wasn't included. It was reproduction,
and
it was about making sure that you didn't get pregnant. You know, that was all that I was really taught.
Yeah, same.
His generation, they do mention that it feels good, and they do mention that there's a clitoris, so that's kind of, we're moving on a little bit. But we still sort of leave pleasure out of so much of what we talk about when we're teaching young people about sexuality. And it's the biggest driver for, well, it's not always the biggest driver for why we have sex. We have sex for a whole bunch of other reasons. But pleasure is a very, very valid reason for seeking out, you know, self-touch or partner touch. And I think when the conversation doesn't acknowledge that, it also then doesn't teach us around how to explore ourselves so that we understand, you know, that the optimal things that our bodies like, and to normalize the fact that we often fantasize about a whole host of things that we may not want to do in reality. It's really not the number one thing I get when I go and, you know, have my hair cut, and a hairdresser asks me what I do, and I accidentally mention that I'm a sexologist, is the kind of, is it really normal that I like looking at women when, you know, when I'm watching pornography, because I don't think that I'm gay? And it's like, this kind of normalization, you know, of how we interact with, if essentially this really big creative space that we have in our heads, if we're allowed free reign of that, and if we allow ourselves to play in that space, there's a lot more freedom to enjoy. But we just, as a society, like, stick all these barriers and, you know,
taboos.
All these you must not, should not, you know, around it. And like, some taboo is nice. It's quite, you know, one of the biggest things, we talk about the four cornerstones of eroticism, and one of the, so almost all fantasy comes down to like four common themes, and one of those is breaking taboo. So, you know, it's quite nice to have the odd rule and boundary around you that you can bash through and enjoy, you know, how that feels. But we just don't talk about this stuff enough so that you have ownership of it. You know, you have a sense of, this is mine to explore, to decide what I want, what I don't want, and what I'm going to seek. And I still don't find, even with the younger women that I treat, because I don't just treat menopausal women, I, you know, treat everyone over 18 in the clinic that I'm in. It's still relatively unusual that I get somebody who comes in who's had a sex positive upbringing, who's had really positive sexual experiences up to this point, and then experiences some kind of massive shift at menopause, where what was really good previously suddenly isn't. That it's often much more layered and nuanced, and there's all these long-standing things that they've carried with them up to this point, and this is just the tipping point.
Yeah, so true, which is where we come away from the more physical side of the body and more inside the psychological mind pillar of probably what you spend most of your time working through.
Yeah. There's someone, and I can't tell, you know, I'm awful with quotes, it's sort of remembering the quote and not remembering who to reference it to. But someone described sex as being a bit like a cake with icing on top, you know, and when you're in it, the icing is all of your neurotransmitters and your hormones and so on. And when you're a young woman, you know, you've got absolutely piles of all the neurotransmitters and hormones that you need that help it to be good. So the actual sponge of the cake doesn't need to be that great. So we can kind of get away with fairly average actual sexual touch and activity because we're primed to feel good with that. But as you get older, you've got much less frosting and you need a much better quality sponge. I think that that's often what happens in this transition is you have to slow down, spend more time warming up, spend more time kind of in what we still consider to be foreplay, which we should really think about as being just a really central part of intimacy. It's like all has the same value, whether there's penetration or not. Mm-hmm. And we need to adapt sometimes what was working for us before, because actually our bodies are changing and shifting and we need to keep up with them. Keep kind of exploring and being curious and working out what we need now.
I could speak to you forever on this. It's just such an interesting conversation to, you know, lift the lid on a little bit and have our listener just really consider, where am I with my own sexual exploration? And, you know, have I actually been true? Have I been allowing myself to explore? And probably a big part of this will be in the communication of things like sexual fantasies and things that we maybe want to explore as we do become a bit more confident maybe in who we are.
Yeah. There's some studies by Justin Lemire, who's from the Kinsey Institute, that says that midlife women have got the most colourful fantasies.
Yeah, I bet.
It's a really interesting, the idea that we need novelty. And obviously the longer that we've been having sex and the longer that we've been with, you know, the same partner potentially, the more in our own heads we go into the, you know, the BDSM and all of the other stuff.
Yeah.
BDSM and group and all that stuff is really highly scoring. And it's no wonder that, you know, 50 Shades did so well.
Because I bet,
into. But that need for novelty when you're in a long-term relationship is just kind of how we're wired. And he showed that if you share fantasy with your partner, if you can find a way to do that that isn't confrontational and that feels safe, that actually really helps within a relationship to keep a thread of novelty running through. But yeah, you're right. I just think pleasure full stop for women, actually. And maybe it isn't just gendered, but certainly I often talk to women about, well, what else are you doing that's pleasurable during the week? You know, what else makes your body feel good? Forget sex. Just tell me, you know, in the last 2 weeks, what you did purely for the joy of how you felt in that moment. And that's often where I think you have to start with women who are invariably busy. I mean, again, I'm being stereotypical, but a lot of us are mothers working, looking after a house, you know, running around at high speed, heads full of things to do. And us at the bottom of that list often, because that's what society teaches us. So it feels really incongruous to say, you know what, sit down, luxuriate in 20 minutes on the sofa, do nothing, you know. And so if we can't do that, how are we going to do that, you know, in that other part of our lives? So I think adopting a principle that pleasure is necessary and a core part of being a happy human, wherever you find that pleasure, it's a really good bedrock for then getting, you know, your sensuality more than your sexuality kind of to be something that you can connect in with again.
Yeah, I love that. And yeah, I absolutely echoing all of that. We do a practice inside my coaching space, which is about our joy bubble. And we have a lot of daily non-negotiables in there that are short and sharp, but some of them, you know, we encourage up to a minimum of half an hour really of daily self-cares. And that can just be a take a white space diary moment to just, you know, what do I want to do right now? Or if it feels bougie to go have a nice bubble bath in the middle of the day because you're working from home and you have time to do that, then we make that a priority. So
it's vital because we live in our heads and we're encouraged and rewarded for being hyper-productive. You know, it's not just that we do that naturally. We also, you ask somebody what they did today, they, you know, you don't get an answer of, well, I kind of got up late and then I had a luxurious bubble bath and then I didn't do much for the rest of the day. It's very much, I cooked, I cleaned, I went and did this, I did, you know, I wrote this entry in my diary, I did this for the book that I'm writing. So sex and sensuality is not always something that is involving lots of thinking. It's got to be something that's felt. And if we don't we're not connected with our bodies. So we've medicalized loss of libido. We've made it very much this thing that requires testosterone, especially in the conversation around menopause. And we've kind of pathologized it a great deal, whereas actually a part of it is that, definitely for some people, but a large part of it for a lot of people is a really logical endpoint to how busy, knackered, tired, fed up, disconnected they are, you know, to their bodies, and how much we live our lives in our heads and at speed, really high speed.
Agreed. I was actually asked a question recently when I was on a podcast, and the question was kind of around about, well, you know, do you think that women have an easier life now or a harder life now? And my answer to that was very much towards that I actually think that we have parts of who we are as women now is a lot harder.
Yeah,
a lot harder. There's a lot more expectation. We're expected to spin all the plates of being mothers and running households and running big corporate careers or businesses. And, you know, was it easier when we were actually maybe in the 1920s, 1930s to not be doing all the other stuff on top of being a mum and a housewife? But equally, I think back to it and I'm like, well, we have a lot more freedom now. Yeah, there's obviously nuances to that in certain parts of the world, but we have a lot more freedom. We have a lot more advantageous opportunities within our life to go do the things we want to do, explore the things we want to explore. But it's quite an invoking question when we think about, is it easier now or is it harder now to be a woman?
They say that the more choice you have, the less happy you often get. And I think that that's possibly part of the issue, because we constantly question, am I doing the right thing? Could life be better?
Yes.
Am I with the right person? Am I in the right job? And I think that that is a really difficult thing, you know, to sort of quantify whether that is good or bad. Yes, choice is really good, but it makes it very difficult for us to just be grateful and to accept what's not. It's normal not to be happy all the time. It's normal not to be successful all the time. You know, I was taught with a feeling wheel when I was doing my psychosex training, and I think we tend to look at the top half of the feeling wheel as everything that we should be trying to achieve.
Yeah.
And pathologize the bottom half where it's about, you know, anger, irritability, but they're really important signals to listen to a lot of the time that tell you that your balance is off. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we help people to feel confident in trusting in how they feel and trusting in their gut instinct about whether something is working for them or not.
Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, there's a lot in it. I'd be inclined to agree with you that I think it's more difficult in many ways, because you feel more responsible for if you're not happy, that maybe something is up that you've chosen.
Absolutely.
You know? And I think that happens at midlife. I think that's one of the reasons why, if you were obviously in menopause early, but for women who are transitioning through menopause at midlife, your 40s is often a decade where you take stock, and in men too. You take stock, you know, have your choices paid off, like time is getting short, if you want to make a change, it's now or never. And all of that lands at a time of real sort of hormonal transition and life transition. So I worry about the conversations we have about sex in social media or around menopause, because it's lovely to have an easy answer. It's great to think that a tube of Antrophem is going to just solve it all. And genuinely, for some of the women I treat, it really is as simple as they were really sexually interested and active. It was really good. And then it wasn't. And if I give those things back, it's good again. But for very large numbers of the people that I treat, this is just like one step that's tipped them over.
Yeah.
And everything was hard already.
Yes. And that's probably where, when we look at this, we've got that ability and the work that both of us do, yours within that kind of the clinical sexologist roles. But it always comes back to the foundations of how well do we know ourselves? You know, a lot of crossover, and I'm completely nodding inside with everything you're saying here, because there is so much that we get to unpack for the people that we support in their journey, that for a lot of the ladies, I'm a trauma-informed breathwork facilitator, and we do a lot of breathing. And actually, that can stimulate a lot of really numbed activity. activity that's happened in the past. And when we start to unpack that, it can feel very traumatic living through that experience again. So there's lots that we can do. So where we have really beautifully had this conversation, there's probably been a lot of things that have come up for many people listening to this right now. What would you then say is maybe your top, I wouldn't call them tips because it goes beyond that, but top piece of guidance for anyone listening to this right now thinking, I've not actually realised that I've potentially had challenges with this until now. What would maybe be your top steps to what happens next?
I mean, I think what you've just touched on around trauma is really relevant. Just the prevalence of big T and small T trauma for most of us.
Yeah,
I think it's really relevant before I sort of get into the tips, because that does correlate massively with what I see in clinic. And women who have experienced trauma are often even more separate from their bodies, dissociated from their bodies, and that can certainly be an issue at this stage. I think my top tips, it's understanding your own voice, actually hearing your own voice, understanding what you want and why you're seeking some help, because I see a lot of people whose reason for seeking help is externally referenced. They're either concerned that they're not going to be a good partner to their husband, or, you know, if they're with a female partner, they're worried about that for the same reason. So understanding what's driving you and what you actually want, what do you miss, and what would you like to have back, so that we're actually doing something that is for you and not for others. And I think learning to notice your body again is a key part of what I do for when I'm treating women. Mindfulness comes all the way through treating problems with sex, because your brain's like a volume switch. You know, you can just as much kind of dial it up, ramp up the eroticism, you know, throw in the fantasy and really be in the moment. And small amounts of touch can be unbelievably erotic, but you can very much do the opposite. And if you are distracted or dissociated, and women who've been through surgery, trauma, cancer treatments, where your body's been unsafe and not a place that you want to be in, we learn to disappear off. So distraction, dissociation. So learning it outside the bedroom, outside of sex, just to come into your body again and practicing that will help you to hear your voice, help you to hear what your body wants, help you to understand what you need. Probably those two things are the main things.
Yeah.
I guess I would be not telling the truth if I didn't acknowledge that the hormonal changes make it a lot harder if we don't address them. So I think it's really important. More about the vaginal estrogen, the stuff that you talked about. I find that vaginal estrogen makes a much bigger difference most of the time for my patients than the testosterone does. And it's often forgotten. In a rush to get that testosterone prescription, we're not considering, how does arousal feel? You know, does it feel as good as it did before? And that needs local hormones. And so that's probably my meandering long list.
I love that. Thank you. So true. And I think that, you know, I would echo the kind of third part on all of that for anyone that is listening to this right now thinking, well, sex is not enjoyable because it's painful, or, you know, I bleed, or even going to the bathroom and wiping after going to the toilet is like sandpaper, regardless of if it's a beautifully soft aloe vera toilet roll. You know, I've been there, I've experienced that, and it's not nice.
And it becomes like a war zone. You know, sometimes I talk to women, I'm like, and we need to do this, and we need to do that. You know, you're creating all these rituals and routines that don't help you to feel sexy, because you're having to do all this stuff just to kind of
feel normal.
So I love getting people to moisturize and massage twice a day in the vulval area, and to use like local low-level vibration, just, you know, a bullet vibrator on its lowest setting. After you showered, you know, I actually use coconut oil for my patients externally, but you can use emollients. As long as it's external, it's inert, but it's more sensual. It's more pleasurable to use that than to kind of get another medical thing and take that into the shower and use that.
Agreed.
So incorporating some of that into your daily routine and trying to incorporate pleasure, full stop, all the way through your days and your weeks, will help you to feel more sensual and erotic, full stop. You know, sex is much bigger, but libido is much bigger. It's zest for life. It's being bothered to do something purely for the joy of it.
Yes.
And we all need more of that, you know?
Yeah, I love that. I'm going to need to read that study that said that, you know, even just having 100 orgasms equals 7 more years on lifespan.
So that's more male-bodied. Really interestingly, for men it's quantity, for women it's quality.
Ooh, interesting.
That study shows. So we would, we are happier and have better quality of life if we have sexually satisfying experiences, whereas male-bodied individuals, this is quite old, so it maybe is changed.
But
male-bodied individuals tend to just want lots of sexual experiences.
Yeah, right. Well, yeah. I'm laughing, but probably just because it's different. I am. I'm thinking about that, and I'm thinking, no, I would rather have the quality of the experience. You know, we're not rushing to the finish line. We're actually allowing ourselves that sexual foreplay and we're having fun with it. I do remember that pre-children, those years. Now it's just a, we hope they don't hear, let's quickly do.
Well, this is it. It's from A to B to C. And I think actually that Karen Gurney always says that, you know, it's a buffet, not a three-course meal. The more that you could think of every single intimate thing that you might want to do or sensual thing you might want to do is having equal standing. Mm. And it doesn't all have to end in penetrative sex or an orgasm. The more freedom you have just to go, I want this little bit of pleasure. I want to have a whole lot tonight. Sometimes I just want this tiny bit.
Yeah, it's so
but
true.
But it opens it up, you know.
I love that. Thank you so, so much for your brain, your energy, your life currency today with us, Dr. Angela Wright.
Pleasure. Thank you.
We will no doubt do a part two at some point. There is so much more that I could just ask you right now. But for now, I am going to just thank you. And for any of the listeners that would like to find out more about what you do, where is the best place for them to find you?
Yeah, so I work in the NHS in North Yorkshire and over in Hull, but I also work online privately. So there's two of us in my clinic, both trained the same way, and it's spicepairhealth.co.uk.
Amazing. We will list that in the show notes so you can just take yourself off there now and click right through to connect with Dr. Wright. Thank you so much. And until next time, stay safe, stay vibrant and stay well. I truly hope this episode has sparked something vibrant inside of you. I ask only one thing. To help keep these episodes coming, please subscribe and share with another in your life. That's how we reach more women worldwide and we help them step into their power. Because together, we are working to remove any of the stigma and taboo that surrounds menopause. This does not need to be a daunting, a scary, a taboo time in anyone's life. So together, let's make menopause mainstream.